Hi, I'm Dylan Taylor, Chairman and CEO of Voyager Space Holdings.
I'm Ken Eppens, Founder and CEO of Orbit Guardians.
Hi, I'm Raphael Rutkin, Founder of E2MC Space Ventures.
And I listen to the Cold Star Project.
This show is for entertainment purposes only and is not what is termed professional advice. The Cold Star Project is proudly presented by the Operational Excellence Society. Cold Star Tech is a supporter of the OPEX Society, and Jason Kanigan is a member of its board of advisors. Talk with us at Cold Star Tech to find out what we can achieve together with your Lean Six Sigma or Operational Excellence programs. And check out opexsociety.org to learn more.
We're back with one of my favorite guests, Paul Rolkins of Agrippa Consulting. We've met before over the last few years, first about his concept of strategic quitting, which I highly recommend, and also on the topic of managing smart people who often have very strong opinions. How do you get them to all work together? And where can you add value as a leader who is trying not to compete with them on a technical level, because they're going to know way more than you do. But there are ways to apply value. So I was looking at what Paul was doing, and he's constantly sharing, like, look, I spoke to the great people of XYZ company today, or I worked with this great company, and these are names that you know. And I was like, okay, well, what exactly are you doing with them, though, Paul? And so he hopped right on to meet with me about it. And so I'm excited to share this with you. This is what good or great companies are doing to become excellent, all right? They're working with Paul, and these are the topics. So, Paul, welcome.
It feels like every time we talk, it's been about 3 months, but you look and it's been a year or 2 years in between or whatever, and we're like, woo! You know?
So amazing.
I'm a big fan, as most people know. I could share your stuff into infinity. It's always applicable, interesting, novel, right? And get you thinking. Folks, I think Paul's email list is one of the best to be on. It's one of the few that I'm on, and he'll email from Holland late at night our time in the US, and in the morning I'll have something wise to wake up to. So appreciate that. So we've talked before about managing smart people and high performance culture and things like that. And there's something that I keep seeing in your LinkedIn timeline, and it'll be something like this. Today I'm meeting with the wonderful people of blank, right? KPMG, Nestle, Uber, Siemens, Bosch, Mercedes-Benz, BASF, and the list goes on, right?
But yeah,
companies,
sure.
That we all know about, right? So I'm sitting there and I'm going, well, I know what Paul does to a pretty good degree. I'm an operations management, operational excellence guy, but I still don't know exactly what he's taking these people through when you do these one day or maybe they're multi-day sessions with them, right? So I wanted to give you the chance to come on and talk about what it is that you do with these folks, what topics you work on them with, what kind of companies hire you, and this sort of thing, right? So I guess start wherever you feel like.
Sure. Yeah, Jason, thanks for being back on the show. Always wonderful to have a chat and a conversation with you. Yeah. Building on your question, my expertise is high performance, and I define high performance as the consistent realization of big goals in the laziest way possible. That would be high performance. So you have three components there. It must be consistent, otherwise you are a one-day wonder. You must think big goals, otherwise if you do something, let's make a dent in the universe. And the third part is doing things in the laziest way possible. So typically, if you look at my clients, those are not lazy people. Those are usually very hardworking people. But the thing is, if you can go from A to B in the laziest way possible, you got time and energy left to do other cool stuff. So that's why lazy is so important. So that's the frame in which I help my clients. Now, with this in mind, typically I engage them to see how they can apply the principles of high performance to drive their own performance. And those questions, they can vary from how can I drive innovation in my organization? How can I drive strategy execution? How can I retain talent? How can I build senior leadership? So there are various applications of this type of concept, this high performance concept, for the clients I have. And then typically, if you then look at the profile of the clients, typically my clients are organizations which are doing very well. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, they are looking for the next step. What is it that they need to do in order to take the next step? So they are very proactive because they don't want to wait till things go pear-shaped, but they want to take the next step in order to drive their performance. So that's when they work with me. And sometimes it's a keynote, which is typically awareness and a couple of tools. Sometimes it's a masterclass where you dive into the details. Sometimes those are team sessions, like strategy sessions, thinking through their strategy and especially strategy execution. So there's also something I do. And finally, I'm also a boardroom consultant, which are somewhat more longer periods of time where I work with a company to implement this stuff.
Okay, excellent. So just thinking about that idea of this is the next step or the level up for them. You know, you might start a business and be like, all right, I want to make a buck. I want to make some money, get a customer, right? Then yeah. You do that for a while and you get cyclical about that. And you think, okay, I need to standardize this, right? And that's when you get into processes and systems. And then you start thinking about, okay, what else do I need? And that's really when culture and leadership seems to rise to the top, right? You should have been thinking about that all along, in my opinion, but a lot of people kind of find that at the catch-up spot. And then now you're doing really well and you're thinking, what's next? And so Paul is next. Now, these were big companies that I named, and you do serve other companies as well, just not as well known. And I wanted to list a few names that people might have heard of.
Sure.
And it might be easy to think, well, Jason, Paul, those are big companies. And of course, they can afford Paul and they need him or whatever. What about a smaller company? Like, you don't really need that. And the first thought I had, just bouncing off that, was, well, I don't know. Most of the big companies I've worked with were pretty siloized and kind of slow, dragging their feet to make changes and innovate and things like that. It might actually be easier to work on high performance culture with a smaller organization that's more agile. Tell us a little about your experience in working with larger and medium-sized companies and what maybe the differences or similarities are. Do you end up working with BASF or something, a division or the kernel of leadership, maybe 10 people or 6 people or something like that? What does that room look like when it's not a keynote, but you're actually sitting down in a classroom?
Yeah, there's a wide variety how engaged clients. So typically, if you look at the big corporates, it can be at the highest senior level. Also, it can also be at the business level, at business unit level or business group level. So it depends on where they need my help. I also work with small and medium enterprises, and that's typically those are companies. Those are usually entrepreneurs. I work with the owner of the company and his or her team. And that's interesting because the difference between the corporations and the small and medium enterprises, first, the similarity, many of the issues they're facing are the same, strategy and strategy execution and innovation. So that may not be different, but the application can be very, very different. Typically, what you see in big organizations is that a big obstacle of the application, what you mentioned, is silo thinking, is the oil tanker syndrome. I've been doing it all the time. So why should we change? And if you change, well, then all of a sudden you stand out from the rest. And is that something you want to do in a corporate environment? Well, these kind of issues play a role. With small and medium enterprises, the big thing there is as soon as they hear a great idea, they start to implement. They start to do, and then you get quick results. So for me, the small and medium enterprises, that type of client work is also a bit of a testing ground to see what things work and how they can raise the bar there as well. So that's a nice combination between the two in the end.
Okay, excellent. Let's say we're taking the position of somebody watching this who is maybe a member of a company like this, middle management, maybe that, oh, my business is different. You don't know about our situation. Who is this guy, Paul Rokins, to come in there? How do you get buy-in, I guess, is where I'm going with this, right? Where the participants go, okay, I'm going to subordinate my will for a moment to you and your process and follow through that and get them involved in building something better.
Yeah, typically the engagement starts with the realization, first of all, they are used to external help and external support, and they engage with brains. But it typically starts with the idea, listen, with the help that we've got so far, it's industry specific, content specific, It has only brought us so far. What has brought us here will no longer get us there. So we need some new and fresh blood. And especially from perspectives which are outside the industry. And that's exactly why they need it, right? So that's the first step. And then the second step is to always frame the conversation in the what's in it for them. And my position is, in order to take the next step, and that's also the key idea which I have seen in the past few years working with organizations, the key idea is, if you want to take the next step, it's not about more, better, faster, but it's about taking things out which are no longer helping you. Right? I call this the Michelangelo principle. Named after Michelangelo, the 15th century Italian sculptor, he created David, that statue.
Right.
And people asked him, how did you create David? He said, I had this raw piece of marble. I envisioned David inside. I simply took out everything which was not David. And that's the Michelangelo principle. So often you help those organizations by helping them to take out everything which is not their David. And that makes a connection, because people love to take out the obstacles, the things that no longer help them, without being forced to do more, better, faster, that play. And in the end, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. And by the way, it's also, philosophically speaking, against doing stuff in the laziest way possible. And so there's a connection there.
Yeah. So less, better, lazier.
Yeah.
Then more, better, faster. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. What if you've got, I can't remember his name right now. He was a guy who worked with Walt Disney. And he talked a lot about creativity and the sort of the Donnie Downers he'd find in organizations who didn't want change to happen. And he actually had a pin for those people that they would probably actually wear. I'll have to think through that is. But what about those people in organizations? For example, you've got a career person who is sort of muddling along, and they're good at one of those things that is not the Michelangelo process or output of the organization, right? And here you come along, and most of the group is with you on the side of, hey, we should cut this. And they're like freaking out, going, oh my gosh, that's my livelihood. This is, you're going to take away my job, right? What does that come up? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Here's my key principle. My key principle, and I teach that to everyone. I tell them, the role that you have in an organization is to make yourself redundant, to make yourself obsolete. And the reason is, if you make yourself obsolete, what happens is you build new skills, and you can use those new skills to become even more valuable. So if people realize, wait a second, my work, if I think about making my work obsolete, I build new skills which I can apply somewhere else where I can create more value, or even in this team, that can be the what's in it for me. So it's very important to frame that conversation. And it's not about making your work redundant. It's about building a new skill set where you can add more value. So that's one part. Here's the second part. The second part is that you always need to go to a place where people love your work. That's the key to success. And if you find yourself in an organization which is developing in a way where your skills, your talents are no longer rewarded or acknowledged, you can do two things. Either try to change the organization, or go to a place where they love your skills and talents. And that's usually the best way of doing it. It creates a lot of energy and a lot of intensity for people making that happen.
Intensity.
Yeah.
Is that a big factor in what you see?
Yeah, because intensity for me is passion. People are usually very intense when it comes to their skills, their passion, what they love to do. And they lose that intensity in environments where this type of skill set is not acknowledged or not used in the right way. Yeah.
Okay. So that would be a signal, if the intensity was not so great before and now it's ramping up, that the people are interested in adapting and evolving.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Mike Vance was the guy who I was thinking
a moment
ago. Yeah. Yeah. Who had the sort of the Donnie Downer. You could actually call Disney up at that time and buy, or have him send you a bunch.
Really?
He just had some printed.
Wow.
So I'm going to go through some topics that I have found in your posts that you work on, and I'd like you to expand on these. If you have an example that's not covered by an NDA that you could share, I mean,
sure.
You know, if
happy to talk
in general, that would be awesome. I think it would tie it back. So, so we've talked about unconventional strategies to achieve extraordinary results in the laziest way possible. Is there an example of that just to cement it into people's heads?
Oh yeah. let me give you an example. When I work with teams, they talk about innovation. My point is, if you are focused on digitalization, if you focus on sustainability, if you focus on high performance teams, that's not innovation. That's a hygiene factor. Right, you no longer exist if you don't work on that one. Real innovation is to try to do things differently. If you do what everyone else is doing, you're not distinguishing yourself from the competition, and you are probably stuck. So, and then I go with them through their thinking when it comes to innovation. And I give you an example. I was working with a management team, and we were having a conversation about innovation. And what I let them do is I let them analyze where do they spend their organizational energy. And what happened is that 99% of their organizational energy was in improvement, right? The Six Sigmas and the improvement here and small improvements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, where they thought if we continue to improve, we will stay ahead of the competition. But then we had the discussion, hey, wait a second, what do you think that the competition is doing? Well, probably they do the same. Here we are. It was a rat race. They could not win. It's a rat queen conundrum. They go faster and faster, but they only need to go faster to stay where they are. So we discussed what is it that you need to do unconventionally with your own focus as senior leadership get rid of innovation activities, get rid of improvement activities in order to focus on really innovation activities to challenge the status quo. And that was an eye-opener for them because they realized that we're very comfortable with the improvement part, but much less comfortable with the innovation part because that was challenging the status quo. Sure. So that's typically an example with unconventional thinking to take the next step.
Okay. I love that. It's the difference between doing things right and doing the right things, because if you're doing the Lean Six Sigma, all you're doing is improving on what already existed. And the safety part of that for the mentality, I'm going to guess from my OPEX background, is just incrementally improving things. You're not throwing the whole thing out and starting over with the total uncertainty of we're going to try this. It's different. Okay. Movement versus achievement. I can definitely tie that to what we just talked about. I had Dave Walker on, who was the past comptroller of the United States for 9 years. And when he started, the measure of a good government report was the number of pages. Right? And he got them to throw that out, reduce the number of pages in a report, and also to reward them for graphs showing things in pictures, right?
Wow.
And so that to me is it's leaning towards that movement versus achievement there. So let's hear more from you about this concept.
Yeah, so I make the distinction. Movement means that you are doing something. Achievement is that you get results. And I think that's the key distinction between the two. And let me make this tangible, what I often see in organizations and where I help organizations to think differently about this area. And it ties back to what you said earlier. If you grow an organization, you're focused on content, you're focused on processes, right? But at a certain point in time, you reach a plateau. You need to take the next step. Now, what I've often seen, and I see that in big corporations, but sometimes see that in smaller and medium enterprises as well, is that organizations, they fall in love with their processes. And doing the process is somehow equal to getting results. So if I do the process, then I will get the results, right? Now, originally, the processes were intended to get the results, but the world has changed. So this requires a rethinking of what people are doing. Instead of doing the process, outsource your thinking to a process, and let's do things differently. And let's focus, for example, on behaviors, which is the next step when it comes to building a high performance culture, where you let go of the processes, reinvent the processes. So instead of movement, you really go to achievement. You're very clear, this is what I want to achieve, and this is where I want to go. And then the second part there is that often achievement, you can phrase it differently. Often you find organizations' achievement has got something to do with revenue and margin, has all the good stuff in the business. That's all fine. But there comes a time that in order to take the next step, it's the revenue and the margin are the result of the culture you're building. Mm-hmm. So achievement can be defined as having a different culture, for example, a year from now, 2 years from now. And that should be the focus of senior leadership, to build that culture, because business results are downstream from corporate culture in the end.
Okay. I can see that, because developing the corporate culture into something new is a leading indicator, right? The revenue that we got from our income statement, you know, that's a lagging indicator. And it's also like measuring your blood pressure.
Yeah.
Right. But blood pressure alone is not really an achievement, right? Yeah. I guess in the short term it could be. Right. If I'm going to die and I need to bring that number down, you know, but just maintaining it, that is hygiene, as you say. And so it's an element of achievement. It's a path or a thing that's necessary as a checkbox along the success. So, okay, let me move on to the next one here. And I'm really not sure. I'm questioning myself if I wrote this down properly now. So if I didn't, please correct me.
Yeah.
Every innovation is a conspiracy against thinking.
Ah.
Did I get that right?
Well, there's some truth in there, but let me expand on that. And let's talk about the conspiracy of thinking first. Okay. What I mean with the conspiracy of thinking is there's an interesting trend, and it's also what I see in corporations. The interesting trend is that everything we do, most of the innovations like digitalization, ChatGPT, is all designed to outsource our thinking.
Hmm.
Right. Ideally speaking, ChatGPT will do the thinking for us. A system of process will do the thinking for us. Right. Hmm. So what happens is that if you focus on outsourcing your thinking, you no longer teach people to think.
Yeah.
And the inability to think also equals the ability to no longer innovate, because innovation, by definition, is thinking. Yeah. So what I mean with the conspiracy of thinking is that the application of much of the innovation that we see right now actually leads to people who outsource their thinking to systems of processes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So my point is, if you want to innovate, you need to relearn people how to think.
Okay.
And that's a fascinating thing,
yeah.
Especially with senior executives. I often ask the senior executives the question, when was the last time you were spent 1 hour with pen and paper to simply think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And the response to that question is shocking. Many people look at me and say, I don't remember. Yeah. Or I think whenever I'm in the shower or whenever I've got time in the car, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens even on a senior level is people feel they are no longer paid to think. Somehow they are paid to do. Yeah, but actually, your key skill is thinking, and that's also what I think. If you talk about skill building, key skills of the future, for me the big key skill of the future is the ability to think. We need to teach you how to think again.
So there's part of me that gets nervous about this. Like I like it and I understand it. But on the other hand, I went to school for 2 years as part of my education to get a diploma in operations management, which was the result of that was to write SOPs, right? Standard operating procedure documents for organizations so that they could hire line employees who wouldn't have to think all that much, right? Just go to sort of mechanically go through the steps and hope that an exception, you know, doesn't get thrown too often, right? And then you do get these senior management folks who haven't, you know, thought in years. And like, I don't blame them. I'm not making fun of them, because I look at myself and I have a book on productivity as an executive and how to be productive. And I am super productive. I probably get most of my work done in about 4 hours a day. But I'll bet you, Paul, if I really looked at it, I'll bet you I'm productive, like on results, achievement, 2 hours a day, maybe. Right. And it might even be an hour. And I suspect for some people it's like 15 minutes. And again, I don't blame them. And it's really terrifying to consider that, right? Now, if we're saying, okay, as an executive, we're bringing you on board to think, how does that trickle down to the line employee, right? Who you're supposed to be hiring, like the, do we really want the McDonald's employee who's flipping burgers to think, right? I mean, what happened? Okay, they could come up with innovation. They could. I don't know. Like, that's a very open-ended question, but let's see where you go.
Yeah. So a couple of perspectives here. First perspective, if you look at senior leadership, the minimum behavior you show yourself is the maximum behavior you can expect from other people. Mm-hmm. From your,
okay.
In other words, your ability, your focus on thinking is a direct representation of your focus on thinking of the entire organization. And if you show a new example, the organization will follow. If you don't, the organization will not follow. So that's one thing. The second perspective is, in order to increase thinking, the key here is the Michelangelo principle. Start taking out everything, every obstacle which prevents you from thinking. And it's often processes and systems and the environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the second approach. And then the third approach, once you understand this, then even at the lowest level in the organization, you can make a distinction. Hey, these are processes and systems. We would like you to do this. You don't want to reinvent the hamburger if we have this straight. But at the same time, I'd love to give you an opportunity to improve and to innovate, to challenge your thinking. Yeah, because I would like to think, especially in an environment which is turbulent, which is volatile, which perhaps is not always as predictable. Because in a non-predictable environment, especially then, your ability to think is crucial, right?
Okay.
Do you really want to have pilots who have outsourced their thinking only to systems?
Mm-hmm.
No. Well, if everything is working fine, that's fine. It's okay. But in case of emergency, you need them to think.
Mm-hmm.
That's a moment that they need to be trained to do that.
Right. Or war fighting. You know? And they have a lot of systems, right? The electronic warfare cat and mouse thing is quite complicated, sure. And very fast.
Yeah.
However, if all we did was abdicate our thinking to that, people would get shot down, I suspect.
That is
a lot more.
Yeah.
Okay. There's more to dig into there. And again, I've been following you for years. We've talked several times. I own your book on preeminence. It's sitting on my dining room table right now, where I actually look at things. There's like two or three books on there that I pick up. And yet I still feel like I'm an idiot about this stuff. Right. And it's shocking. If you're by yourself, if you're an owner of a small business and, you know, you've got a dozen or less fewer people working for you, and you know, like, nobody means it as much as you do, right? Where would you begin in thinking about things and looking for that Michelangelo principle and applying this stuff?
He would be my first question. And my first question is, are you happy? Own of a business, are you happy?
Yeah.
And that's often a very revealing question, because sometimes people tell me, Paul, I'm perfectly happy. Yeah, because I do what I love to do. Mm-hmm. But often I get a response, and not really. That's why I ask you to come.
Yeah.
And 9 out of 10 times, what happens is that at a certain point in time, their ownership has somehow morphed into management. All of a sudden, they're no longer an owner, an entrepreneur, but somehow they are a manager of an operation. Yeah. And those are not necessarily skill sets which they have. So it takes them a lot of time and energy to do this stuff. Yeah, so it, based on the answer to that question, then we set out, okay, what needs to be done here? Either you need to become entrepreneur and owner again, so we need to set up your organization in a different way. You step out of management role and start to do entrepreneurial stuff, or if you like to do the management stuff, well, how can you organize it in such a way that you have time left to think and do things differently and go to the next step, if that's something that you like. So that's typically the first step that I would take with owners in organizations.
So willingness to change and admit the truth. Those are
definitely
huge things. Okay. You talk about resilience and we've talked already about that. Running to get faster at running, but everyone else is doing the same thing. So, like, all right, I'm not ahead in the marathon here. And so how do you get to that achievement of doing well or thriving in difficult times by developing this resilience? What does that mean to you, and how do you apply it?
It's one of the key questions, and especially for my corporate clients, is how to prepare for the next crisis. How to prepare for
it. Okay.
That's an interesting question, right?
Yeah.
Because, well, they know something is coming. You don't know when, but you know something is coming. And the answer to that question, and that's about resilience, because the answer is not to predict the future, mm-hmm. because you can't. History teaches us one thing, you cannot predict the future. Yeah. It's no point of predicting the future. And everyone mm-hmm. thinks they know the future, by definition, is wrong. Yeah, so it's not about predictability, it's about being ready for the future itself, and that's about resilience. If I work with resilience in organizations, typically, again, Michelangelo principle, I take a look, what is not your David, what is the stuff, the obstacles which create fragility in your organization. I give you a practical application of how I do this. Often they have strategies, and this is where we are, this is where we want to be. So a strategic plan. Now, in order to improve on a strategic plan, here's the trick. Then I do an exercise with them. It's called a pre-mortem. A pre-mortem? Yeah, pre-mortem is the opposite of a post-mortem. Post-mortem, you look at a failed project and you said, okay, what went wrong? Pre-mortem, you say, look at this strategy. Imagine 3 years from now, you fail so miserably that Wall Street Journal is making a front page article about how not to do strategy. What happened? Very simple. And then people start to think. And the team start to think, oh, this, and we didn't include this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And once they have the list, then the next step is, what are the systems or processes you need to build in order to prevent this from happening? And it's based on the simple idea that if you want to achieve success in strategy, the trick is not to fail. So if you avoid failure, then by definition, you have success. Yeah. So this is a practical application, how you make your organization much more resilient, much more robust to deal with the next crisis.
Okay. So planning ahead, wargaming, hypothetical situations, and then planting resources in place and contingencies. So you're not predicting. You're not saying, I know it's going to go this way.
No.
You're going to say, there's 15 things that could blow up in my face here and lead to death. How am I going to not have these things happen or try to avoid them from happening? I think of major economic crises in the United States. Presidents and departments, commerce heads have tried to do something in some cases. Japan, right? The most successful presidents seem to leave it alone. And they get bitched at about it. They get complained at about it, but they let the market recover. Rather than trying to fight it and subsidize things and do something about it, right? And they just let supply and demand get it to recover. And it would happen faster in a couple of years instead of 4 or 8 years with intervention. And this is something that we've seen in economics. So very interesting. High performance teams. This is a critical sort of engine of innovation and achievement for you. Are high performance teams an achievement in of themselves, or are they just like the check mark of the good blood pressure?
I think it's both.
Okay.
Typically, high performance teams, if you create one, you get the results. If you got the results, you also attract or build high performance teams. So you can't separate the two. If you talk about high performance teams, here's the essence of high performance teams. Together, they do what they need to do. Individually, they do the stuff they are very good at. They're highly talented. Doing the stuff. If you want to build high performance teams as a leader, a couple of things are important. First of all, focus on building on strength. It's much easier to become 2 times stronger at the stuff you're already strong at than trying to improve 10% of the stuff you're weak at. So that's one thing. And the second thing, if you want to build high performance team, is to take out everything which makes a team weak. Which makes a team low performance. That's very simple. Yeah. And let me give you a couple of examples, which I have often seen in teams when it comes to leadership behavior. Here's an example as a leader, which is excessive heroism. Being a hero, right?
Yeah.
And being a hero means that as a leader, you think every single problem of the team is your problem. You need to face it. You need to solve it. And then the team can go ahead. Yeah. Now, if you continue doing that, at a certain point in time, the team will think that you are the one solving problems, so they don't have to do that anymore. They no longer take ownership, and they let you do all the work and all the thinking, and that's not high performance. So heroic leadership is typically a pitfall if you want to create high performance teams. And that's an unconventional way of thinking, because we are part of a culture where running after the ball and getting things done and stepping in, it's being rewarded. Often you have organizations which reward the heroes. So that type of thinking is necessary in order to take the next step to high performance teams.
Okay. Fortunately, we're not in a situation like Dan Carlin would describe in Hardcore History about Japan coming out of the 20s and going into the 30s, making the decision to modernize, become an imperial power, and become an eat or be eaten sort of culture, right? And the bar for heroism there was so high, just for a regular person in society. It's like, what do you do to exceed that, right? What crazy action do you have to take? I want to hear about maybe one or two examples of high performance teams that you've worked with and that division of labor. And I also want to know how long, if you went into an organization that didn't have the trust level there yet, right? Where people are kind of looking over their shoulder at the other experts, right? And going, are you trying to stab me in the back, take my job, take credit away from me, take resources from me? The grant money goes to you and not me, for example, or the budget. How long does it take to sort of straighten that out and get these folks to work together? Let's start with that. And then maybe examples of like when it's running well, what does it look like?
Well, typically, if you look at my clients, they tend to be successful, right? So they have a track record of success. So they tend to be smart people, already doing a lot of things very well. They also tend to be in a position that they've tried a couple of things already, but they didn't get the results yet where they want to be. So they're open to change. Now, if you want to have change in an organization, change in a team, the first connection is the what's in it for me. You need to make the what's in it for me. If we are able to do this, if we are able to organize ourselves differently, what does it mean for you personally? How will you benefit? And then often people will see benefits which they do not have yet, which they do not see yet. So that's the first, make that connection. I'll give you an example, building high performance teams. I was working with a tech company. Tech team. It was a team, I think, of 20, 25 people. They tend to be very smart, and they needed to innovate. They had something great in mind. They need to innovate. And what they realized is that they had 25 very smart people, but there was one who was brilliant. And then they realized, wait a second, if you want to innovate quickly, how do we need to organize ourselves? And what I did is I introduced them to the Gundam principle. Gundam principle. And what's a Gundam? A Gundam is a big robot who has a small human inside a robot doing all kinds of stuff, and the big robot is doing the work. Now, what a Gundam organization is that you have one super talent or a few super talents, and you build the entire organization around those super talents in order to ensure they can do the job. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you put your ego out of the way because it's about the results getting there. And that was a great concept for them because they realized, wait a second, if we are able to build a Gundam here for these one or two super talents that we have in the team, we get the results that we want to have. And then there is a next step that perhaps someone else steps in and become the super talent for the next step as well. Yeah. So let's do the work. Let's organize ourselves in such a way that those super talents can do what they need to do. So the entire structure, that culture, was focused around them doing the work that needs to be done. And after a couple of months, they achieved great results. Ego was out of the way.
All right. Now, it's an interesting example, and it's definitely applicable for that kind of situation. Because it immediately, in my mind, runs up against the, well, wait a minute, we don't want one superhero doing all the work, right? And so how do you get around that? Do you rotate who's in charge of the robot, depending on what the project is? Or do you say, look, this team is in charge of this result, and that's the way it's going to be for a while until this person quits, gets exhausted or dies or something like that.
Yeah. Here's the best practice. The best practice is to ensure that the project has a moment of completion.
Okay. Yeah?
So it's not a situation you want to have all the time. For the next 40 years, you will become part of the robot. You'll never be inside the robot itself. That's not the case. But here's a project. We want to be successful 6 months from now. So Gundam principle, this is how we organize ourselves.
Okay. That makes sense.
And that takes a strong leadership, by the way. Huh? Especially leadership, understanding, listen, leadership doesn't mean that I'm the smartest of the group.
Mm-hmm.
But I am the one who's able to organize the group in such a way that the smart people can do their job, right?
Right. I feel that ought to be me, folks.
Yeah.
That should be my role, you know? I know enough to talk to the experts, but let the experts do their job, right? And let them get the resources in the organization. Yeah. How does the client retain and use what you give them?
A couple of things I always focus on when I work for a longer period with a client. First of all, I will give them stories, metaphors, and language, which they can use consistently within their team, but also outside their team. Yeah. One of the language, and we mentioned that, hey, it's the Michelangelo principle, strategic quitting, I also call this. So once they got this language, all of a sudden it becomes much easier for them to address the issues that they're dealing with. So that's one thing, language, metaphor, stories. The second thing, in order to maintain momentum, is that I help them to set new behavioral standards. When it comes to the behaviors in their organization. For example, I help them to make a shift from pleasing to serving.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I help them to make a shift from being nice to being honest.
Mm-hmm.
I help them to make the shift from playing not to lose to playing to win. Yeah, so there's also language, but once they understand, hey, this is about behavioral change, then all of a sudden these new standards will become part of the routine, part of the process, part of the systems in making that happen, right? So that's the second thing which I do with them. And these two, language, metaphors, and stories, and behavioral distinctions, that is typically what is most important for the DNA in order to maintain success.
Okay. And that's how you're getting at the culture eventually.
it's
the behaviors and what direction are you pointed in? What's your North Star and what are you fighting for? Okay. You have mentioned you've got a book that will be coming out that focuses on this concept of, I think one of your TED Talks, the majority is always wrong.
Right.
I see that and I've listened to it and I'm like, yes, it's true. And then I go, well, there's wisdom in crowds though as well. So tell me about who this is for, what they'll learn, why they need it.
Yeah. So a couple of things about the book. It's about unconventional strategies to achieve extraordinary goals, right? And it is key principle here is taking stuff out, Michelangelo principle. Mm. Yeah. And the book is about how to apply the Michelangelo principle to different aspects, typically of an organization, typically of a corporation, how to apply it to drive innovation, how to apply it to create high performance teams, how to apply it to drive strategy execution, how to apply it to overcome thinking biases, how to apply it to improve resilience, how to apply it to improve decision making. Yeah. So that's the key. That's the key idea of the book. The key idea is to help readers, usually part of an organization that can be corporate, it can be a small or medium enterprise, but typically from somehow leadership or professional or ambitious people who want to become a leader, help them to think differently. Yeah, with the philosophy to take things out in order to take the next step. Yeah? So this is not about a book about more productivity and more, better, faster, and raising the bar, and et cetera, et cetera. No. It's about taking two steps back and think differently. So that's why I wrote this.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm writing this.
Definitely going to need that. Folks, you heard me sigh earlier as Paul was answering one of the questions I gave, because I was having the realization that that's what I need to do again. And it's it's a never-ending process, right? You have to do it every so often. How often, and I know we've covered this previously, but I want people who haven't watched that or listened to that interview to hear, how often should people be reviewing their goals?
If you want to become an unstoppable goal achiever, here's a simple way of doing it: twice a day. Twice a day, write down the 10 most important goals that you want to achieve half a year to a year from now on a piece of paper. Don't top of your head, right? So don't look at what you wrote down earlier, top of your head. Do this morning, evening. And if you start doing this for about 30 days, you continue to write down the same goals, but also you move quickly achieving those goals. And this has got something to do with the fact that this is the way to put it in the subconscious. Once it's in the subconscious, you see people, ideas, circumstances to achieve your goals. So reviewing your goals, become an unstoppable goal achiever twice a day. That's very powerful. Now, if you are in a corporate environment, here's the trick: more than you think. More than you think, especially when it comes to strategy. Often what I see in organizations is that people tell me, we communicated a strategy half a year ago. I wonder, why is no one working on the strategy? I got news for you. Every single team meeting, let's go back to your goals and the strategy. Start with that one. And you, as a leader, you need to continue doing that. And you know you're on the right track when people start to complain.
I'm looking for the book What to Tell the Man in the Mirror. It's a Harvard guy. It's again, you have to tell them so much. To tell them again and again and again. So often they begin to mock you, was what he was saying. And that was a 2012 video. So that has been around for a while.
Green advice.
It's this idea. I mean, I know from my personal experience, again, and it's going to sound like I'm an idiot here, but and in many ways I am, I guess. But at least I'm honest. I forget my goals in a week if I don't review them, right? And I will drift and I will pick up what's new and exciting as the new thing in the moment. And we'll see, and then maybe I'll stick with something and finish it, and maybe I won't, right? Maybe it'll drift out and get replaced. And if I don't have the darn goals written down and in front of me, there's a couple things that are in front of me every day to look at, I will just drift and forget and get into this, what's exciting in the moment, right? And this is beyond firefighting, folks. This is not, there's no pressure here, right? This is just intellectual curiosity, looks over here, looks over there, and suddenly, you know, 3 months have gone by and you have not achieved a goal that you said you wanted to do. It's so easy to fall into this practice. So what Paul says again, and you saw my face as he said twice a day, again, he's told it to me before, guess who forgot? And I watch these interviews, you know, occasionally. So it's so easy to drift and forget. Paul, who or what level of management or leadership is the right kind of person to reach out to you, and how should they go about doing it?
I think a couple of characteristics from a leadership point of view. It's important to have the ambition to take the next step, right? The willingness to do it in a somewhat unconventional way. The standard stuff you already did, you already had successful, but hey, what is the next step in order to make that happen? So I think that's one characteristic. The second characteristic is the willingness to work with a team, with your team. So it's not something you do alone. Hey, I work with my management team, I work with my senior leadership team in order to make that happen. So I think that's the second characteristic. Now, typically my process is if you think, hey, this might be a match, we have a chat and then we discuss if I can help you or perhaps someone else can help you as well, right? So reaching out to me, very easy. Go to my website, go to my LinkedIn. I have a Twitter, I have a YouTube channel, so there's multiple ways of reaching out to me. I work all over the world. Actually, businesses nowadays are global, so I work all over the world. And feel free to reach out, and then we can see what we can do here.
Okay. As far as websites go, you have paulrokens.com
Paulrokens.com,
and Agrippa as well.
And that's the same. It's the same website. Huh? So okay. My company.
Send it over.
I run my company. Yeah.
Okay. I will link to that in the notes below. If I don't, please remind me. All right. I really appreciate you doing this again. We always have a great time. I'm reminded of principles that I ought to remember. And it's just like I said earlier, it's astonishing to me because I do review this stuff and I try and implant it in my brain and it still falls out. So all the more need, right, to be talking to somebody like you. Thanks again for doing this, and I look forward to when your book comes out. I'll get a copy and hopefully we'll have another chat about that.
Excellent. We go from there. It was a blast being on the show. Thanks, Jason.
All right. I hope you got as much out of that as I did. Paul, thank you very much. Folks, Paul has one of the most insightful and briefest email newsletters, quote unquote. I can't call it a newsletter really because it's not that long. He calls it that. But there's always a great, valuable, less than one page content insight in there. So I highly recommend you go sign up for it. I'll leave the link in the description below. And I appreciate him being here. And I appreciate you too. Thanks for listening.